Take a chair and move over to this side.
Well, good evening. Last year I worked here as an electrician, or more accurately as an electrician's helper in a 1 month pre-opening work month. I worked here for 2 weeks and my chief activity was to change electric light bulbs. There are more than 1,000 bulbs all over the village and a good percentage, several hundred were burned out, so I was really quite busy these 2 weeks to go from cottage to cottage and from lodge to change light bulbs. And now I have suddenly in been promoted to a member of the faculty and I'm supposed to give talks. So I think I should explain how this came about. I gave this introductory lecture of Cabbages and Kings last Monday, and I was all set to talk tonight about power in the Northwest. But Carol asked me to tell you again about this Cabbages and Kings business, and what I'm going to discuss are three items. The first item, me. Not because I consider myself important, not at all, but I think I owe you to tell you a bit about my background and how this whole thing came about. Now that's the second point, how it came about that I'm here. And the third point, what do I mean by Cabbages and Kings? What does this title mean? So first, about me. I was born in the last century in a city the size of Seattle, which does not exist anymore, a city which has changed its name, a city which was to a very great extent destroyed in the last months and weeks of the World War II, and which has even changed its population. It was a German city, I came from Germany, now it is a Polish city. The name of the city was Breslau, size 500, later 600,000. It is now Wrocław. The German population has completely disappeared. The city was obviously terribly destroyed by artillery and by fire in the closing months. I was not there, I was in this country then, but I have a book and a description, a gruesome description. The population was in the complete grip of the Nazi machine, which was just knowing that its time was fast running out, but relentless as such a dictatorship is. Everybody was made at penalty of death to stay and to fight. The civilian population couldn't leave, and so it was a very disastrous thing. And then when the war was over, Stalin told the Polish people in a very airy way, I need the eastern part of Poland to secure the borders of Russia. I have to set that up as a buffer. If you want to compensate for that, I have no objection that you go into the eastern part of Germany. So this was then the reason that these provinces became Polish. For us here living in America, Germany is divided into two parts, into West Germany, which is the Federal Republic, which is run on the same lines as our government, and into East Germany, behind the Iron Curtain, which is the communist ruled dictatorship set up by the Russians, but ostensibly run by the German Democratic Republic. Now for the Germans, the situation is different. The Germans speak of three parts of Germany now. West Germany, what we call West Germany, then what we call East Germany, they call Mitteldeutschland, Central Germany. And then they speak of East Germany, meaning the lost provinces, which are now Polish, and one province, East Prussia, Russia. So I just want to get that straight as a matter of record. I do not think there are any people to any amount still living in these lost provinces. They all fled into what is now Middle Germany or East Germany, and then they continued fleeing into what is now West Germany. I have quite a few friends who live now in West Germany who came safely into these regions after terrible ordeals, but now they are quite well off and living just as well as we do here, I would say. Now, I was born in this city and raised there. I went to school. I went what is called in German a humanistisches Gymnasium. This is a high school whose chief emphasis on the classics. So I had 9 years of Latin and 6 years of Greek and 6 years of French and 4 years of English and a number of different subjects like geography and history and religion. You see, religion was then taught in school as a required subject. There were only three religions in Germany then, the Catholics, the Protestants, which were synonymous with Lutherans, and Jews in the city, quite a few. And so then we had the three first teachers and then the higher grade ministers of these three denominational groups coming into the school and instructing us in religion. And we were graded like in any other subject. My confirmation class was given by a pastor in his study, and we had released time for that. And then I was confirmed, and then I became a very good Christian, going twice a year to church, as the Germans usually did, at Easter and at Christmas time. Because the church was a state church, the ministers got their salary from the taxes which were levied together with the other state taxes, and from this money the churches were painted and maintained, and the interest of the congregation was absolutely nil. You see, that's a situation which unfortunately still persists in other countries. I understand in Norway and in Sweden the situation is not very much different nowadays, because these are state churches, and if a church is supported by the state and does not rely upon its membership, well, then the conditions are not what they should be. Now, this went on merrily until Hitler came into power, when the situation became tough, not only for the Jews, but also for the Catholics and also for the Protestants, that is for the Lutherans. Then people started to become aware that something was going on, and then finally the church split. There was one group, the Deutsche Christen, the German Christians, which threw in their lot with the Nazidom, and the other group, the confessional church, was then founded by those pastors who thought the Nazi doctrines would be incompatible with the teachings of the Christian church. And these pastors, and who formed the Bekenntniskirche, the confessional church, had to be supported by the membership. At this moment, when the church was imperiled, then and then only we members became aware, and we started to become really interesting and to support these pastors morally and financially. And they had to meet first, they met first in the churches, and it was forbidden to them to meet in the churches. So they went into rented halls and into private rooms. And then a real religious life awoke. But I'm a little bit ahead of myself. After I had finished my school, I went to Technical University. I studied electrical engineering. Despite of all this Latin and Greek, I was always had a very strong bent to engineering. My father had been an MD, and my grandfather had been an MD, and by then I was a little taught. Everyone said, "Ah, you will be a doctor. I said, "Absolutely not, I will be an engineer." And they thought it's a big joke. Then a 3 years old fellow talks back and says he knows what he's going to be. Well, I became an engineer, got my degree as electrical engineer, and went to Siemens. Siemens is one of the very large electrical manufacturers in the world. Siemens and AEG, Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, are the two very large electrical manufacturers which can be compared to General Electric and Westinghouse in this country. And the only reason why you don't hear anything from them is that they have an agreement with GE and with Westinghouse not to invade each other's territory. So no GE or Westinghouse equipment is being peddled and sold in Germany and vice versa. No Siemens or AEG equipment is sold in this country. But in all the other foreign markets, they are in fierce competition with each other, as well as with the large electrical manufacturers of other countries like England, Austria, Japan, France, Sweden, and whatever they are. All right. So I worked there with Siemens for 2.5 years as an engineer in the electrical laboratory. Got a very fine continued education while I earned my money. But at that time, there was already inflation going on. I was hired with a salary of 10,000 marks, which seemed enormous, but it was a paper mark which was very little, they had very little actual value. And during the next year, the value of the mark went down so fast that in the closing days, before stabilization, within 1 week, the mark was depreciated to 1/10 of it was before. So it was 10,000, and then within next week, it was 100,000, the next week it was 1 million, and then 10 million, and then 100 million, and then it was 1 billion. And at 1 billion, when the thing was completely dizzying, then the thing came to an end. But I remember very distinctly that I worked as an engineer at Siemens, and we had to stay after closing hours until the armored truck from the Reichsprinting office arrived, and we got our banknotes with all these meaningless zeros, and on the very same evening we had to go to the city and to buy something, because on the next morning the money wouldn't have bought anything. So on this evening I was still able to buy a can opener for a day's work, or a book from a peddler on the street. The conditions were absolutely fantastic, you have no idea. And one of the very, very important things was that the middle class, not only those people who lived on salaries, on retirement payments, were completely pauperized. The middle class, which had a stabilizing influence, it has a stabilizing influence everywhere, was completely wiped out. These people were absolutely destitute, and as a consequence, we had a rise of the extremist party, a great, great rise of communists, as well as of the Nazis. This is a subject in which I do not want to go in great detail. The other day I was asked extempore to give a discussion of the rise of Nazism in the same room at the fire. So I discussed that. It took me the whole evening, so I don't want to go into it. But I just want to tell you that this is one of the contributing factors that Nazism came to power. The stabilizing middle class was wiped out. The houses were bought up by foreigners for a song, you see, because at that time of complete chaos, this was very easy. None. Then there came a stabilization, and there came a kind of more orderly conditions, but of course the Nazis already were in the ascendancy, and in 1933 they had then attained the power, and then the dictatorship ruled. But before that happened, as far as Ludwig Roman is concerned, I changed my job from Siemens and got into the government services. I worked with the research department of communication, which was attached to the post office. Now this is common, not only in Germany, but in many other European countries, that the entire field of communication is under the auspices of the post office. The post office is not only responsible for letters, it is also responsible for telegraphy, for telephony, for broadcast, and later it became responsible for TV. That is from the technical point of view. The programs are run, in Germany at least, by regional groups. You see, you have transmitters in cities which transmit then programs characteristic for the city with the city news. You have regional programs which could be compared to the program of a state here. And every once in a while, rather frequently, you have the national hookups and also international hookups. But at any rate, the whole system is run by the state, and I remember very distinctly, this was still the time of radio, there was no TV, that we had to pay 2 marks, which is 50 cents, every month to the letter carrier for the privilege of running a radio receiver in our home. Now, naturally, there was no advertisement. All right. So that's the way it was handled over there, and the way it is still handled over there. In England, you still have the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, which operates the TV, but there is in England also now an independent broadcasting system, which is on a commercial basis, which is privately supported and consequently has advertisements. And then, rather interestingly, you have read that there are these pirate stations which are beyond the 3-mile limit, either on roving boats or on old fortifications which have been abandoned. So they are outside of the law, unless the law has changed, and they bombard now the unhappy islanders with rock and roll and advertisements. This has gone on for quite some time, and I read about this in the Manchester Guardian, which is a very fine magazine, Manchester Guardian Weekly AML edition, which I get every week and which keeps me informed of what is going on outside of Spokane. All right, so I worked then with the government. It was interesting, it was certainly very fine. It was work in the forefront of a technological development, and I was very fortunate and very happy that I could get my doctor's degree then while I worked with the government just on the side, which was very fine. Okay, then in 1933, Hitler came to power. Now, the interesting thing is that this did not happen with an enormous bang. Of course, there was a parade and there were shouts of joy and fanfares and all kinds of monkey business, but the transformation of a government, which was run on a democratic base, the Weimar Republic, you see, into this totalitarian state, did not take place overnight. I can speak only of our research organization. Our research organization, which was about 800 engineers and technicians and theater personnel, was a very highly trained group of specialists. It was utterly impossible to throw these people out and replace them with brown shirts. This wouldn't have worked. So he had to play the Nazis had to play along with them. They had to ease themselves into power. And how was this done? First, of course, we were swamped with literature. We had to listen to all talks of the Führer, all business stopped, and everybody was requested then to sit and to listen. We had the loudspeakers in the offices. And then there were indoctrination talks given, which we considered as a joke. People simply didn't go. So the Nazis very quickly cottoned onto that, as the English people say, so they got wise to it, and they issued then cards. And there stood the trusty fellows stood in and the doors and punched. So everybody had to punch, you see, and then he could go in. He was captive audience. So then these people were talked to and preached to Nazism day after day after day. You see, during the working day, say for 3 quarters of an hour, instruction in, of course, not in Nazism, but in the doctrines of the state, you see. So this was the way it went. And then started at the same time a subtle but most effective campaign of terror and intimidation. We who worked with the communication service knew at once that the telephone lines were tapped and that those people who were considered enemies of the state had their messages recorded. And of course, so we were a little bit careful. So, but not everyone was careful. I remember very distinctly I had a superior of mine, Oberpostrat, and I showed him a set of curves. There was a technical thing, highly technical, I don't want to go into. There are telephone handset frequency curves, and one curve pertained to the standard German handset, one curve pertained to the standard British handset, one curve to the American handset, one to the French handset. You see, different companies made different apparatuses which had different curves, and I plotted a number of curves on a beautiful cross-section sheet in color. I had red for one and green for something else and brown for something else, and I don't know, the German curve I think was green. And I showed these curves to this man who was known to be a scoffer. He scoffed about the Nazism because he was a superior counselor, if you please, an Oberpostrat, and he thought he was sitting pretty tight, and so he could just scoff it. And I came to him and said, Oberpostrat, these are these curves, and you see, now this green curve, here's a German curve. He says, green, Dr. Römer, don't you know, you should have drawn this curve brown. We are now in the area of the brown shirts. Well, you should have brought red, because red is the color of the swastika. Don't you see that? You seem to be behind the times. 2 weeks later, I went to this office again and said to the secretary, can I see Oberpostrat? She said, he isn't here. I said, well, where is he? He isn't here. I said, don't you want to tell me? Is he on vacation or is he on business trip? I was rather impatient. She said very stonily, he isn't here. Blank wall. Then, of course, I found quickly out he had been forcibly retired. And he was lucky. He wasn't put into a camp, into a concentration camp. They just set up concentration camps. But you see, this was the attitude that was typical for the way these things were handled, you see. So I do not say that when Hitler came to power, it was like a trap which was sprung and you were then done in for. Not at all. It was like a noose, a silken noose, which was playfully thrown over your neck. Oh, that's not fun, you see. And the next day there was a little tugging on it, just for fun, you see. And the next day was a little bit more tugging. Until one day you found out it has been pulled so tight that you couldn't take it off anymore. You see, this was the situation. Now, I saw this from 1933 to 1936. And in 1936, my wife and I, we said, we have two children, aged 3.5 years and 4.5 years. We are not going to stand that any longer to have our children brought up in this atmosphere. Because it was an all-pervasive atmosphere of terror and of intimidation. I do not want to go into the religious field. I can only say this. A dictatorship cannot tolerate anything else. So if Christ has said, render unto Caesar what is under Caesar, render unto God what is to God, this is a doctrine which is utterly, utterly, utterly unacceptable to a totalitarian regime. The totalitarian regime is Caesar, and there is no God besides Caesar. The whole idea of a God, of our God, of this Jewish fellow there from Asia Minor coming there, preaching forgiveness and meekness and weakness and taking everything ends, and loving everybody. It was something which the Nazis, you have no idea how they scoffed about it and how hard they tried to stamp it out, to ridicule it and to eradicate it. Of course, there were great difficulties. There were many, many people who spoke up. There were Catholic bishops who spoke up at the danger of life. There were many Protestant pastors, the pastor who buried my father and later my mother, he spoke up. And he disappeared in a concentration camp for months. I have seen him repeatedly since then. He will never talk what happened. And this was one of the conditions. These people were not to talk, and they did not talk. And they even do not talk now. The pastor who married me, who baptized my children, Pastor Seeberger in Berlin Tempelhof, he was a member of the confessional church, naturally, and he disappeared. He was back after 6 weeks and took his services as if nothing has happened. This was still before we left, maybe 1935 or so. But the situation got, the noose got tighter and tighter and tighter, so we went away. And how could we do that? Well, I was most fortunate that I was an engineer, and it is up to the American consul in Berlin, to have the absolute and indisputable power to say whom they want and whom they do not want. They can take people who are extremely rich, who would be able to support themselves and their family for at least 5 years, because it takes a minimum of 5 years until you become a citizen. During these 5 years, you are still an alien, and you must not, under any circumstances, fall into a category which needs relief, because there would be no relief forthcoming from the American authorities. So you have to show that you are able to support you and yourself for 5 years. Now, who could do that at a time when the mark was already way down, because the Hitler regime certainly was not discounted very highly by the international exchanges. So the value, the monetary value of the mark, though it had been stabilized then in the late 1920s, you see, I told you about that, this took place in 1927 or 8 or whenever it was. But now in 1936, the mark was already way down, so even if you had plenty of dough in Germany, it would not have been sufficient to support yourself. Now, there were churches, there were other organizations in America which gave affidavits that they would support you. But who was lucky enough to get such an affidavit? Maybe some pastors who had stood up and who were known to their brethren here in this country. At any rate, I was an engineer, and engineers are apparently people who are looked at with a certain favor, because that's an industrialized country. If I had been maybe a lawyer, certainly the consul would have turned thumbs down on me, because German law, of course, is absolutely of no value in this country. So we were accepted, we were put on the quota, and we came to this country, and we landed most happily and most gratefully on the 22nd of September 1936, on a rather sultry day in New York. We passed the Statue of Liberty, at the base of which it is written, give us You are refuse and you are teething masses. We will take some very beautiful and very emotional. Of course, we didn't know it at that time, but we visited the statue later on and we read these things. All right, so we were there. We were in a one-room apartment, very modest beginning after we had a very affluent life in Berlin. My good wife came from a quite wealthy family, but she was standing by through thick and thin. She thought it marvelous that we had cleared out. But I still remember, she telephoned one day with good friends of ours, and I heard her talk about Germany in such an evasive way, and so talking around the subject, that I nudged her and said, Gabi, speak up, we are now in free country, you can talk. So this terror still was in us for weeks and for months. The idea of that we could shed it right away. This didn't work. So we were there in New York, and it took me 7 months until I secured my first job. This was in Hastings on Hudson, about 15 miles north of New York, and I worked there as research electrical engineer with Anaconda Wire and Cable Company. This is a subsidiary of the Anaconda Company here in Montana. Here they produce the copper, they mine the copper here and in Peru, and then one of the finishing subsidiaries is the Wire and Cable Company, which uses then this copper to make wire and cables. So there I worked until 1952, and in 1952, when I was already 53 years old, I got the invitation to come out here into the Northwest, to Kaiser Aluminum, into the new research department, which was then set up in electrical engineering as a senior engineer, and I dropped everything like a hot potato and started life once more anew in the beautiful Pacific Northwest, and now I'm here. Now, let me tell you a little bit about our experience in Hastings. When we came to this country, that is even before we came to this country, we made two solemn resolutions to which we stuck. The first resolution is never to compare anything in the new country with the old country, because this is the quickest way of making enemy. If you say, well, in Germany it was done this way, you see, this is not right. You may have seen things which were strange to you. Take them at face value and say, well, the Americans certainly must have some good reason to do it this way. So this was point one. The second point was that everything which we liked, we would say, golly, isn't that wonderful? And everything which we didn't like, we didn't see. Now, we were mature enough that we could stick to these resolutions, and we really followed through. And this had the consequence that we very quickly became accepted as potentially new, or as potential new citizens, and it didn't take long for my wife to join the League of Women Voters, and for her and for me to go to the PDA and to take care in all these activities which are typical for a good American. We went to the city council in Hastings, and there were furious discussions whether the garbage should be thrown into the river to build up new land, or whether it should be rolled into some of the folds between the hills there. You see, extremely important problems. See, we were right in the midst of it. But at the same time, we were close enough to the metropolis, to the 7 million metropolis, that we could take in their museums, which were free of charge, and I delighted in the beautiful Rembrandts and the French Impressionists, and in the Museum of Natural History, and in free concerts, and in all these things which the big city could offer. We were very fortunate that we did not sit in New York, where hundreds and thousands and ten thousands of German refugees, most of them Jewish, but a good percentage also Christian, came and clustered together. They had that, oh yes, in the old countries, do you remember? Yes, Frau Geheimrat, yes, Herr Kommerzienrat, yes, Herr Regierungsrat. And I was already Ludwig, I was Ludwig Röhmann. I was very proud of that, you see, in Hastings, because we were the only family who had arrived at that time from the old country, and so it worked. Very, very nice. I had naturally some difficulties in getting adapted to the American way with my 9 years of Latin and 6 years of Greek. I used in English, which caused my colleagues plain despair. And they said, Ludwig, if you continue writing this way, that we have to run to the dictionary for every word you write, you won't last long. Can't you use simple words? Can't you make your sentence short that one can understand them? Instead, you make them like a freight train, one kind, one kind. So I had to learn that. I had to learn to simplify my language and to learn simple, nice Anglo-Saxon short four-letter words, you see, which I had not learned in school, you see. All right, but this was more difficult. So there I was in Hastings, and our children went clear through school, my son from kindergarten to 12th grade, and then he went to the Navy. My daughter went from kindergarten to 11th grade, and then we came to Spokane. I would like to say a word about this school business. The kindergarten teacher of both of the kids was Mrs. Reiser, and I have never seen a more wonderful person than she was. She introduced these five-year tots to the very essence of democracy and American way of life. These kids elected a president of their class and a vice president, a treasurer, which levied one penny per week, I think. I don't think a secretary, because the kids couldn't write yet. But at any rate, they took votes, and the minority cheerfully agreed with what the majority had decided. And this, I tell you, impressed me without end, because it was contrary to the German way of life. The Weimar Republic was patterned after the democratic way here of America. It was a wonderful constitution. The only trouble was that it didn't work, because the Germans had been taught for better part of two centuries to obey orders. They were archdukes, and then they were kings, many kings, Prussia, and then they were an emperor. And at any rate, you got an order and you followed this order. Any idea of having a mind of your own was completely out of the question. And when suddenly the Weimar Republic came upon the Germans after a lost war, they were unable to run themselves in a democratic way. And the minority, instead of cooperating with the majority, as I saw it so graphically done by these five-year-old tots, instead of doing that, the minority was sitting back in sullen obstruction, didn't cooperate, and tried to throw roadblocks in the way of the majority wherever it was possible, you see? And this was one of the contributing reasons of the downfall of the Weimar Republic. Again, a very complex subject. It had also something to do with the difficulty of training the now again defeated Germans after the last war into the American way of life, you see? I think by now, after some 25 years, they have cottoned on a little bit to our way of life, and the present republic, at least in federal Germany, is pretty well established, you see. In the Weimar Republic, in the closing days of the Weimar Republic, before Hitler came to power, there were 32 parties in parliament. One was the party of the house owners, the other was the party of the renters, you see. There was no national politics. Everybody tried to pursue its own interests, and everybody obstructed everybody else. So the whole thing came to a complete breakdown. This was, again, one of the contributing factors why the extremists, the communists as well as Hitler, could rise to power, and it was then just that Hitler crushed the communists. I have heard it many times saying, we rather recruit our followers from you communists, because you are trained in extremist way and extremist thinking and in extremist methods, rather than from this from this middle class, which is bound to die anyway because it is completely enfeebled. Well, all right. So I spoke of Miss Reiser and of the training which the kids got in school. Certainly they got a first-class education in this country. And I did this work at Anaconda, which I think was satisfactory, and published papers and was in committees, and so this was fine. But when I had the chance to come to Spokane, I dropped everything. And my wife and I, we said, well, let's start life over again. And we came out from the east with its rather inhospitable climate. You see, those who are born in the east and who are accustomed to these long, humid springs and summers and falls probably don't mind it too much. But when you come from a country in which these high humidities are unknown, it was not too easy to bear. So when we heard that here in the Northwest there is no air conditioning and there is no humidity, well, of course, we came out. And I am here since 52, and I worked these 12 years with Kaiser Aluminum in a still more responsible position. I had still more fun. I got from national work into international work, was a U.S. representative at an international organization which met every 2 years in Paris, and went over every even year, and even now I do that every even year, 58, 60, 62, 64, 66, and I enjoy that very much. Now this worked all right until my retirement. I have to interject the personal tragedy that in 59, my very beloved wife died after 24 years of a very happy marriage. And I considered that, of course, at the moment when it occurred, as a great tragedy. So I never was bitter. I thought God must have a reason for that. And now looking back, I would say it was a blessing because it gave me two insights, two very valuable insights which I did not have. The first was the insight, and this is something that the ladies especially should listen to, an insight into the never-ending work of a housewife who faithfully and without ado and without fanfare discharges her duties toward husband and children and toward community and toward church. You see, when this my wife suddenly was wiped out and I had to do these things, then I really got an appreciation. And of course, I have this appreciation for every woman who does that now, while I didn't have it before. And the second point, which is maybe still more important, is this, and I bare my heart before you. While my wife was alive, I was rather withdrawn, and I stuck to my guns as what you call a scientist or engineer, a man who was highly respected and a little bit feared, because my wife, she was very outgoing, she was very jolly, she made friends with everybody at the dropping of a hat, she was already in long conversation and exchanged recipes, and she went to the YWCA and she made pottery as thick as this, you see. She was brought up in a house in which you had only the finest Chinese porcelain where you could look through, you see. But now she really could dig into the clay, and oh, so that's the way she did it. I would say we discovered in America all kinds of hidden characteristics which we both possessed, but of which we were not aware in Germany, because in Germany it is a rigidly stratified society. It was unthinkable that my wife could hang curtains. This was done by an interior decorator. Frau Dr. Röhmann couldn't hang curtains. And Herr Dr. Röhmann, if you please, couldn't replace a broken window pane. I would call the glazier to do that, you see. And that my son would go around selling newspaper would be highly incompatible with my social standing. So this is just a thought which I just want to throw in. But coming back to the death of my wife, she was the outgoing type. I was the scientist who was sitting more or less in the ivory tower. After my wife had passed away, I said to myself, now, Ludwig Franz, can't you at least try to adulate your wife, to be a little bit nice to people, to be a little bit outgoing, to talk with people, and to talk to people. So I gave myself a push, so to speak, and I started to become nice and outgoing. And now I'm talking to you, you see. I wouldn't have thought of doing that 10 years ago. It wouldn't have come into my mind. So this, I think, is a great blessing which came out of a situation which I first considered a great tragedy. Well, all right, so my friends at Kaiser who knew me, they really said, Ludwig, totally changed person, completely unrecognizable, jolly, everybody on first terms with everybody, all the girls, everybody. I had three going away parties, not only one in the Midwest where the cable plant is, and there was a totally unauthorized, unofficial party. Everybody was in, bringing food, doing lunch period, all the mechanics, all the girls, every big affair. And then only in the evening there was the official party with talks and so on and presents. This would not have occurred hadn't I changed. Okay, so this was in 1964 when I was retired. Now this came as no surprise because I knew when I would be 65 I would be retired, and I looked forward to this retirement not with dread, and that's an important point, but with some regret because it was the end of my professional career, but also with great anticipation because it gave me a chance now to do things I always wanted to do, not only traveling, which I always like to do, to tear around in my little car, but to explore credit union work. The credit union had a bulletin, on bulletin board a notice, we are looking for a director, which seemed to me rather funny, this way to do that. And so I went to the office and said, well, I know nothing about credit union, but I'm very glad here to help you out. So before I knew, I was the secretary and played that for 2 years. And even after my retirement. And I tell you, I had the most delightful contacts with these people, with the what you call blue-collar workers from the mill, brilliantly intelligent and sincere people who worked for the good of their fellow employees. And I enjoyed that very much, that I learned something about credit union business on the side. This is just my own gain. But I made friends, and this, I think, is at least as much of a gain. Then, of course, I visited the court sessions. I went to the police court. I want to see how this is being handled. I was quite surprised about the wonderful patience of the presiding judge with respect to people who brazenly had violated the law by drunk driving. I wanted to see that. I was never in police court before, so I thought, come on, it's time to go to see. I went to the Superior Court. I went to the federal court. Then I had several meetings of the city council. I went to our mayor and said, well, here I am, a free man, and if you can use me, fine. So I got a wonderful form letter back that he had put that on the file, and so that's that. But then I got into an organization. Then I got into the organization which is called ABC, Associations for a Better Community. That's an association of associations in which I have no business because I don't represent anybody. But now, when they ask me, whom do you represent, the stock answer is the people. So I got always a big laugh, and I am accepted, and I am on their mailing list, and I take place in I take part in these discussions and meetings about fluoridation and sewerage. I am now an expert in trunk sewerage and in storm sewerage and in sanitary sewerage and all these things, if you please. But also in freeways and in beautification of the riverfront and sundry subjects, you see. Okay. And I didn't talk about my activities in church matters. Well, that is pretty evident, because now I tell you how it came about that I am here. I said to you, I was here last year at changing light bulbs. Now, this was very nice. But then I got again on the mailing list of Holden, and I got one of these letters of our good friend Carol. And in this letter, he said, now we have the meetings here, the retreats for the young people, and then we have meetings for the married people. And then we have meetings and retreats in the end of the year for those who lie on the shelf. And so I wrote him back, dear Carol, I was highly touched by your letter, but I was equally amused because according to your categorization, I am lying on the shelf. Nothing can be further from the truth. If you would see how I am going around in my life from morning to evening, in addition to that, of course, I feed my cat and I cut my lawn and I harvested 2,500 raspberries. I kept tabs how many I harvested, you see. Being engineer counsel, 2,500 raspberries, quite nice. So I have to do a few things, taking care of my car, naturally doing my own shopping and cooking and so on. Well, all right, so I said, I certainly do not lie on the shelf. So the next letter which came back said, I was amused by you. And I said, yes, you see, I'm going places to every 2 years. As you know, I go to Europe. I just went clear across from the southern tip of Sicily to Iceland and stopped in Rome and was incidentally blessed by the Pope. So everything turned out beautifully. So I wrote him the card. And so he said, why don't you come to Holden and why don't you lecture? Well, it is against my principle to say no. So I wrote him in my letter, well, I'm very glad to come to Holden and to lecture. Provided you permit me to lecture on any subject of my choosing. And provided maybe we can call this lecture series of cabbages and kings. Well, so he said, all right, come up and lecture on cabbages and kings. And that's what I'm doing. And now I want to tell you just where this rather strange term of cabbages and kings comes from. It is a quotation from Alice in Wonderland. There are these two Alice in Wonderland books by Lewis Carroll. This is the edition, the beautiful edition, which came out in 62 to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Alice in Wonderland. And let me just read a sentence here. Alice's adventures were born on a golden afternoon in July 1862, when the Reverend Charles Ludwig Dodson, better known as Lewis Carroll, took the three small daughters of Dean Liddell of Christ Church, Oxford, on a boating trip. It was especially to please his favorite of the three, Alice Liddell, then 10 years old, that Carroll began to invent the whimsical details of Alice's encounters with the white rabbit, and so on and so on and so on. So this is the way these two wonderful books, Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, came about. I am very partial to them, and in that respect, I am not alone. They are the best known and best loved books of the English people, and there is hardly any number of the Manchester Guardian in which there are not quotations or allusions to Alice in Wonderland. And to conclude here this presentation, I will read you this wonderful, wonderful poem of the Walrus and the Carpenter, which is recited by Tweedledee. That's in the chapter Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Tweedledum and Tweedledee, we have these two twins, which, as a special whimsical side idea, were mirror images. So when Tweedledum raised his right hand, Tweedledee automatically raised his left hand. Okay, so Tweedledee recited the following poem, and I ask you to relax and to listen. The sun was shining on the sea, shining with all his might. He did his very best to make the billows smooth and bright. And this was odd, because it was the middle of the night. The moon was shining sulkily because she thought the sun had got no business to be there after the day was gone. It's very rude of him, she said, to come and spoil the fun. The sea was wet, as wet could be. The sands were dry as dry. You could not see a cloud because no cloud was in the sky. No birds were flying overhead. There were no birds to fly. The walrus and the carpenter were walking close at hand. They wept like anything to see such quantities of sand. If this were only cleared away, they said, it would be grand. If seven maids with seven mops swept it for half a year. Do you suppose, the walrus said, that they could get it clear? I doubt it, said the carpenter and shed a bitter tear. Oh, oysters, come and walk with us, the walrus did beseech. A pleasant walk, a pleasant talk along the briny beach. We cannot do with more than four to give a hand to each. You see, two people, four hands. The eldest oyster looked at him, but never a word he said. The eldest oyster winked his eye and shook his heavy head, meaning to say he did not choose to leave the oyster bed.
but four young oysters hurried off, all eager for the treat. Their coats were brushed, their faces washed, their shoes were clean and neat. And this was odd, because, you know, they hadn't any feet. Four other oysters followed them, and yet another four, and thick and fast they came at last, and more and more and more, all hopping through the frothy waves and scrambling to the shore. The walrus and the carpenter walked on a mile or so, and then they rested on a rock conveniently low, and all the little oysters stood and waited in a row. "The time has come," the walrus said, "to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings. But wait a bit," the oysters cried, "before we have our chat, for some of us are out of breath, and all of us are fat." "No hurry," said the carpenter. They thanked him much for that. "A loaf of bread," the walrus said, "is what we chiefly need. Pepper and vinegar besides are very good indeed. Now, if you are ready, oysters dear, we can begin to feed." "But not at us," the oysters cried, turning a little blue. "After such kindness, that would be a dismal thing to do." "The night is fine," the walrus said. "Do you admire the view? It was so kind of you to come, and you are very nice." The carpenter said nothing but, "Cut us another slice. I wish you were not quite so deaf. I have had to ask you twice." "It seems a shame," the walrus said, "to play them such a trick after we have brought them out so far and made them trot so quick." The carpenter said nothing but, "The butter spread too thick." "I weep for you," the walrus said. "I deeply sympathize." With sobs and tears, he sorted out those of the largest size, holding his pocket handkerchief before his streaming eyes. "Oh, oyster," said the carpenter, "you've had a pleasant run. Shall we be trotting home again?" But answer there came none. And this was scarcely odd, because they had eaten every one.